Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The U.S.-North Korea relationship has been sour for decades, but it's hitting new lows recently. Four Americans are now detained in North Korea on charges of so-called hostile acts and subversion. The North Korean regime continues to conduct missile tests, and although recent ones have failed, there were some successes earlier this year. Meanwhile, multilateral nuclear weapons talks started by the Obama administration stalled out years ago, and the Trump administration indicates it'll step up efforts to eliminate North Korea's nuclear program. Here's Vice President Mike Pence speaking on CNN at the Demilitarized Zone a few weeks ago.
As the president's made clear that we're going to abandon the failed policy of strategic patience, but we're going to redouble our efforts to bring diplomatic and economic pressure to bear on North Korea.
Today in The Exchange, what's next for the U.S. and North Korea? Let's get your questions in. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests for the hour with me in studio. Chris Reardon, he's an associate professor of political science and founder of the East Asian Studies minor at UNH. And Chris, it's really nice to see you. Welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be here, Laura.
Also with us from Dartmouth, Jennifer Lind, Associate Professor of Government at Dartmouth College. She focuses on international relations and East Asian security. And Jennifer, a big welcome to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Well, and Jennifer, I want to start with you before we get into all the stuff that we need to talk about, including those South Korean elections just yesterday. Why does North Korea, Jennifer, seem so odd? You know, described as reclusive. The regime is described as paranoid. Just an outlier in the world of nations. Why is North Korea seemingly so different from everybody else?
Well, it does seem really different, and you could think that partly it's because of its economic posture. It's a very autarkic state that's taken a path quite different than its southern neighbor, so there's a huge contrast there. It's missed this whole globalization bandwagon. It's very isolated. It doesn't have allies, so it's not in the U.S. alliance network in Asia, which is a large, thriving network. Neither is it close with basically any other country. Its closest supporter, China, is basically keeping an arm's-length relationship. And then there's all the violence that we see out of North Korea. And there, I think a lot of people see it as capricious, and they use the word crazy a lot. They look at the nuclear tests, the missile tests. They look at the domestic issues like the purges and the assassinations, and it might look kind of crazy to a lot of people, but both of those act.
And Jennifer, I think we're having a hard time with your line, so we will call you back. What do you think, Chris, this image of North Korea, paranoid, violent, you pick your word, it's definitely not like most countries.
It's not like most countries, but when I think about North Korea, in certain ways, I'd love to go, but I wouldn't dare, considering that we've got four Americans who have been detained. But there's something about the system right now. It's very reminiscent of what China was like in the 1960s and early 70s during the Cultural Revolution, where you had a leader who was put up on a pedestal. Now, of course, Kim Jong-un is not his grandfather, who was more of a Mao Zedong type, but the whole idea that you would not challenge the party, you would not challenge the leader, the what Jennifer was just talking about, the whole bit of being self-reliant, which in North Korean nomenclature they use 주처, which is in Chinese, it's self-reliance, zili gengsheng, and it's a policy, it's a strategy that the Chinese really pushed. And in the 1960s and 70s, we used to say the same thing about China. It's a crazy place. They're doing all types of weird things. They've got atomic weapons. So in many ways, for a China person looking at North Korea today, we can kind of look at the equivalent back in the 60s and 70s, that there was dynamics going on. It's only now we're finding out what they were.
So how fair a characterization is it, Chris, that North Korea is, as you put it, a crazy, weird place?
Well, if you are as poor as North Korea is, if you were located on a peninsula in which not only do you have the Americans, you have the Japanese, you have the Chinese, you have powers and the Russians that had all occupied them one time or another within the past 100 years, then you would be a little paranoid yourself about what you're going on. One of the problems we have, I think, about trying to understand about another country is putting yourself into their position. And, you know, we sit here with both oceans and protected for 200 years. Of course, we're not really protected now since 9/11, people have woken up. Well, for the Koreans, they have been faced with this threat for hundreds of years. And this recent discussion by President Trump about China being in control of Korea, that really reopened a sore, because that this is one of the many burdens that the Korean people, both North and South, have had to deal with. Trying to establish their own identity, trying to establish their own independence while facing a very, very strong imperial China, a very imperialistic Japanese power, a occupying Russian force, and then the Americans coming in who sides with one side.
So I hear you on the history, and you do get a little paranoid if somebody, yeah, some big power is always breathing down your neck. But still, I'll turn to you, Jennifer, back with us. You know, you look at North and South Korea and, wow, I mean, South Korea, the economy is so dynamic. They have this amazing, you know, vibrant pop culture scene. You know, it's just, it's a pretty impressive place. And so you just go, it just couldn't be more different.
Absolutely true. Did you hear my first comment, or was I not?
Well, go ahead and finish it up there, because I think we did lose a little bit of it. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I think, again, the existence of this stark contrast with South Korea is partly what makes North Korea seem so different, is you have this above and below the line, these completely different societies. If you look at the satellite photos at night, you see this vibrant, thriving, lit up South Korea, and you see blackness in North Korea. And the contrast just couldn't be more stark. And partly, again, it's because of the economic organization, the economic structure, and the nature of their global participation in the global economy. And partly it's because of the domestic regime type. And I want to go back to something that Chris said, though, which I think is really key, is this notion of understanding why North Korea is the way it is and does what it does. And we in the United States are really bad at this, at strategic empathy. And we say if somebody acts in a way that we don't like, then they must be crazy. And if you think about it, North Korea is a very poor economy, very weak. Its economy, by the way, is smaller than New Hampshire's. And it's facing the global superpower allied with a far superior southern neighbor. And so it's facing an existential security threat. It is embattled. It is extremely weak. And so that's the context in which they say, hey, we think nuclear weapons could help us out in this situation. That doesn't strike me as being crazy. That strikes me as being what most countries decide in similar situations, including NATO, by the way, against the Soviet Union.
Well, we should definitely talk about the nuclear weapons and all that testing that's gone on. I want to invite our listeners to join us as well. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're looking at what's next with North Korea, and there's been a lot going on. 1-800-892-6477 is how you can get your questions and comments in. Or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So all of you, just as we were preparing for the show yesterday, South Korea, of course, held its elections. And the winner, Mr. Moon Jae-in, is said to be a big supporter, even one of the architects, Chris, of something called the Sunshine Policy. Now, what is that?
Well, it's interesting. I've been teaching about the Sunshine Policy since the 1990s, but I didn't realize until I was doing a little preparation for this that it's coming from Aesop's Fables.
I didn't know.
Yeah, I know. And it's now another story I'll throw in to make students remember this, that the idea of the north wind and the sun, that had a bet who would be able to convince the fellow to take off his cloak. Well, the more that the north wind blew, the closer that he held his cloak, while with the sun beating down on him, that idea of persuasion. And that's where that's one of the ideas where this idea of sunshine law coming in. And the former leader of South Korea, Kim Dae-jung, put forward this sunshine law or approach in order to persuade North Korea, instead of taking a more aggressive stance toward the South as well as international relations, that the South and the North could be thinking about more about unification and about working together both politically and economically. And as a result of that sunshine law, you did have two of the presidents visit Pyongyang, which had not happened before. You had investments going in just a little north of south of Seoul, in the Kaesong Industrial Zone. You have other industrial zones that are set up toward the China border. You have a tourist vacation spot up in the mountains, very famous Kumgang Mountains. And all of this looked like they were going to be able to convince the North Koreans that it's better to work with us, to enjoy our economic growth, to be able to absorb some of our technology, and we'll be able to improve things together. You'll be able to get some money to be able to buy the food, buy the technologies. And unfortunately, with complications after the developing their own atomic weapon and so forth, the Sunshine Policy has just pushed to the side. And it's past couple of years, past two presidencies, there's been a completely different approach.
So this President Moon is a big supporter of this warming feeling towards North Korea, the economic ties, the exchanges and so forth, families getting together.
He was the chief of staff of the former president, the second fellow that Noh Tae-woo. Nomu-hun, who was the other fellow who would visit North Korea and really push this whole idea of greater economic, I don't want to say integration, but begin steps toward greater integration between the two economies.
So, Jennifer, how does that sunshine policy fit in with what the United States has been saying, which is until North Korea dumps its nuclear weapons, we want to isolate you even further?
Well, with respect to the sunshine policy, I would emphasize there's a few different angles. There's an ethical angle, there's a political angle, and you could also talk about the pragmatics of it. Is it actually going to work? So, first of all, if you've got a situation where North Korea is testing nuclear weapons, testing missile technology, then the problem would be that a benign policy, or one even seen as rewarding North Korea, is ethically quite questionable. Is this something that we should be doing, that South Korea itself might want to ask, is this something that we should be doing to a regime that's doing its best to flout international law and so forth? It makes it even more complicated, and this is where we get into the politics. If North Korea is not just testing weapons technology, but if it's actually killing South Koreans, and so, for example, sinking a South Korean ship like it did a few years back, so if North Korea is actually in the process of shelling South Korea or murdering South Korean soldiers and so forth, Politically, that's going to be a tricky policy to hang on to. And then you have to ask at the bottom line is, what is your goal with such a policy? If the goal is, hey, I think that if we're really nice to North Korea, we can talk it out of its nuclear weapons. Well, that policy has clearly failed. They under the Sunshine policy, have redevoted and very energetically pursued North Korean weapons. So that clearly is not going to work. If you say, well, and Chris mentioned this, what if the goal of the policy is we're accepting North Korea's nuclear weapons, we understand we can't do anything about it, but we're going to try and make North Korea's economy less of a disaster, looking more toward the potential for unification, for example, when the we don't know what time or what circumstance that might occur, but we could do things in North Korea, we can help build it up in a way such that unification would be less of a disaster from Seoul's standpoint.
Is anybody still even really thinking about unification, Jennifer? I'm almost surprised to hear you talk about that.
If you're talking about any sort of conflict on the Korean Peninsula, you're talking about unification. That's the outcome. If there's a Korean War, then South Korea is going to win that war. North Korea will not win that war. Its best outcome would be a stalemate, and that's why it wants its nuclear weapons. That's what they're for. And so the outcome would be a South Korean unification, so a Republic of Korea unified under South Korean control, probably allied with the United States.
Our phone number here in the exchange, again, is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We're exploring the U.S. relationship with North Korea this morning, and it has been a difficult one, including stalled nuclear talks and some of the other acts of violence that our guest Jennifer mentions. Let's get your questions, comments, concerns in at 1-800-892-6477. Matt in Vermont sent us a note. He says, understanding others is important to peace, but so is the past. Matt says, how many past deals has the North reneged on? Do your guests wish to see the North continue the policies of labor camps and repression? Let Moon try a deal, but don't be surprised when and if it fails. If Moon wants U.S. troops out, then I say leave. Matt, thank you so much for the email. And, you know, I think he's making the point, Chris, that North Korea has, you know, isn't just a poor, misunderstood place. They've been a nasty actor.
Undoubtedly. I actually was a commissioned Army second lieutenant when I was about to when I was given my commission, one of the areas where I could have been sent was to South Korea. And I was really concerned because another lieutenant was hacked to death by a North Korean border guard. And
wow,
the stories,
at the DMZ?
At the DMZ. And then, as we were just talking about, having the four Americans who have been captured or have been supposedly been detained because of, for one, either spying or defacing posters. But the email writer is absolutely correct. The North Koreans have reneged on various deals, including they had signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. They pulled out of that around 2003. The whole agreed framework in which the six-party talks back in the 1990s, which was when the six powers, the Russians, the Americans, the Chinese, the South Koreans, the Japanese, were all trying to convince the North Koreans not to develop nuclear weapons. Well, the North Koreans would say that there was some reneging on the American side. Well, the Americans and others would say that the North Koreans reneged on that deal. And so eventually, you know, the North Koreans did develop nuclear weapons, and they did throw out they got out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They threw out the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors. So there is a degree to which that the North Koreans, very much have to watch their compliance with agreements. But there's also a degree to which I think we should look at the historical context. What was the South Korean policies at that time? Were they trying to engage, or were they being far more conservative and being more aggressive toward North Korea. So,
All right. Well, Matt, thank you for the email. We'll take more of your comments in just a moment. Stay with us.
Ideas come naturally to writers.
Ah, I wish.
But how are they with deadlines?
I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like, if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it.
Apparently, they're just like the rest of us. Whether you're looking for inspiration or commiseration, subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, with tensions building on the Korean Peninsula lately, we're looking at what's next for this region, including South Korean elections and the new president saying he wants to adopt a sunshine policy toward North Korea. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our two guests have been watching North Korea for a long time. Jennifer Lind, Associate Professor of Government at Dartmouth College, where she focuses on international relations and East Asian security. Chris Reardon, Associate Professor of Political Science and founder of East Asian Studies at UNH. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And, you know, earlier we were talking about an email that Matt sent in, just reminding us of some of the, you know, very nasty actions that North Korea has taken, saying that understanding the past is important, but we also need to look at the actions of the other side. Let's go back to the past, both of you, for just a little bit and hear how this whole Korean War ended in the 1950s. Here's President Eisenhower on July 27, 1953, announcing the signing of the Korean War armistice and commemorating the Americans, the many Americans who died during 3 years of fighting there.
Tonight we greet with prayers of thanksgiving the official news that an armistice was signed almost an hour ago in Korea. For this nation, the cost of repelling aggression has been high. In thousands of homes, it has been incalculable. It has been paid in terms of tragedy. With special feelings of sorrow and of solemn gratitude, we think of those who were called upon to lay down their lives in that far-off land to prove once again that only courage and sacrifice can keep freedom alive upon the earth.
Again, that's President Eisenhower, 1953, announcing the signing of the Korean War armistice. And Jennifer, you know, notice we don't say the end of the Korean War. What does that mean, an armistice?
Well, we're still at war, technically, in terms of the way that it ended. It was a ceasefire, but the war is still technically going on, and it really draws our attention to the fact that we have this situation that has been, it has settled into this kind of uneasy stalemate over the last several decades, but we have been in this standoff, and any time there's this risk that it could launch into a much broader conflict, an active war. And some of the incidents, like Chris just mentioned, the one where the American soldiers were trimming a tree in the demilitarized zone, and the soldiers were killed by North Korean soldiers. Other times when we've had there's just been numerous very uneasy moments in the relationship over the past several decades, where people were really, really fearful that this would lead to a general war. And so understanding that precariousness, It's interesting because it's precarious, but yet it's lasted for such a long time. So we have that combination of we've settled into this standoff, but at the same time it remains very dangerous, as we've seen in recent weeks with people getting more and more concerned about this.
Well, and again, to our listeners, if any of you have been to the demilitarized zone or you have relatives who fought in the Korean War, of course we'd love to get your thoughts on this topic at 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. How well do you think, Chris Reardon, most people understand this idea of an armistice? And I'm kind of struck by what Jennifer says, that it means we're kind of still at war.
Well, it's one of the first things that I tell my students at UNH, because they certainly, first, many of them don't even know where Korea is located. they might know something about K-pop, but outside of geographical locations, and they have no idea about the suffering as well as the amazing economic success of Korea. But when it comes to the armistice, I think that nobody really quite understands that. And I think that there's been all types of issues about the armistice, whether in the mid-1950s when the United States introduced nuclear weapons to the peninsula, there was a claim that we had violated the armistice. Then there was the idea that we would be meeting annually, a regular basis in Panmunjom at the peace house that was set up there. All of these things have, while meetings have been continuing on over the years, the idea of being able to transform that armistice into more of a peace treaty, I believe, is one of the primary goals of the North Korean government. They want to push this conflict put to the side and be able to continue on. They become, thus when they are being very belligerent, I think in many ways they're trying to say, we will stop being belligerent if you actually bilaterally with the United States engage in a peace talks with us.
So peace talks saying, look, we're two different countries and the war is over.
I believe that's one of the primary North Korean goals.
What do you think, Jennifer?
Well, I think, again, understanding North Korea's sense of embattlement is really key here. And going back to the email you read from our listener, the notion that we're going to be able to talk North Korea out of what it sees as its key survival, get-out-of-jail-free card, that the notion that we'll somehow come up with something that will make it tempting for them to say, okay, maybe we don't need that vital guarantee of our survival, it's really far-fetched. It's not going to happen. And so we keep hearing calls for, well, let's have more talks and so forth. Maybe, the Sunshine Policy will work this time and so forth. They're not giving these weapons up, and until we understand and empathize with the severity of their security threat, which is us, by the way, until we understand that, it's just going to continue with all this confusion that we're seeing.
I got to completely agree with that. I don't see how the administration thinks that the North Koreans are going to be giving up their nuclear weapons or the missiles.
Well, that's the hope, and it was expressed recently by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Here he is in an interview with NPR last month, presenting what the Trump administration expects from North Korea. Let's hear.
A denuclearized Korean peninsula. It's very clear. That's China's stated policy. It has been our stated policy. It's been the stated policy of our allies in the region. And I would quickly add, we did our part. We took our nuclear weapons out of the Korean peninsula. It's time for North Korea to take their weapons out as well.
So that's Rex Tillerson again saying, look, our expectation is, and by the way, everybody's expectation in that region is that North Korea will demilitarize, denuclearize. Are you saying, Jennifer, that's unrealistic or completely unrealistic?
I think it's completely unrealistic. I think that this is exactly what people always say, and particularly in the United States government, because we have a strong commitment to a nuclear non-proliferation policy. So we continually say, it's unacceptable to us that countries get nuclear weapons. So I understand why we say it, and I understand the value of the policy that we have. But again, if it's going to impede progress that we might be making toward North Korea, if it's going to make the situation in North Korea more dangerous, then that's just not a good approach to have.
Chris, go ahead.
At least in the past, the Trump administration has been extremely critical of the Obama administration's policies toward Iran and attempting to keep the Iranians from nuclearizing. And the implication is that I'm not sure. Are they saying they want to apply the same type of a policy toward North Korea? I don't think it's going to happen. First off, the whole thing with Iran is maybe a waiting action. But with North Korea, why would they give them up?
Because they've got them already.
They have them already.
Well, again, in that interview, Secretary of State Tillerson said that, understanding that North Korea feels threatened by the U.S., so he hopes to convince North Korea that the U.S. does not present a threat and therefore doesn't need nuclear weapons. Let's hear.
And we do not seek regime change. We do not seek a collapse of the regime. We do not seek an accelerated reunification of the peninsula. We seek a denuclearized Korean Peninsula. And again, that is entirely consistent with the objectives of others in the region as well.
And Secretary Tillerson, again, you know, making the point, as he did in that other clip we heard, Chris, that it isn't just the U.S. saying this. You know, other actors in the region want North Korea to denuclearize as well. Does that increase the pressure at all? Or does North Korea say, you know, to heck with all of you, I don't really care?
Well, obviously, the Japanese and the Chinese don't want a nuclearized North Korea. We tend to forget that. Well, we don't really know if they have the ability to make a small enough nuclear weapon to put it on top of their missiles. But their short-range and medium-range missiles do have the range to be able to hit Tokyo and Beijing.
And there have been a lot of tests.
There are a lot of tests, and some of them not successful. We've had unsuccessful ones, too. But they recently have had both submarine-launched ballistic missiles as well as medium-range ballistic missiles. So I think the new dynamic that's going to be happening, Tillerson was making these comments before the South Korean election,
right,
where it looked like President Trump had been able to convince the Chinese that we're all going to put pressure on North Korea, that this had been the priority of the administration. And I understand why. But with the election in South Korea, I'm not sure that President Moon will be willing to go along with the United States. Instead, he now seems to be willing to work closer with the Chinese in finding a solution to the North Korean issue.
Well, and he even said, I was reading this just this morning, that resolving the problems on the Korean Peninsula should be led by South Korea. So he seems to be saying, Chris, you know, look, U.S., this is our neighborhood. Let us figure it out.
He's representing a very strong political group within South Korea that has not necessarily wanted a more aggressive approach toward North Korea. And the Chinese and they have been very aware of the Chinese objections to THAAD, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System that the United States has recently moved into South Korea. And the Chinese have actually been very aggressive toward the, not just the American placement of these, but they've been boycotting South Korean goods and stores in China. So I'm seeing things that when Tillerson made these comments, things have completely changed now.
With these South Korean
elections. With the South Korean elections.
Well, I definitely want to follow up a little bit later on that missile defense shield, because you're right, that's another huge issue in this area. But a couple emails have come in, and Mary says, my son, who was born in Korea and has studied and worked there on and off, just returned from South Korea. When I asked about North Korea, he said that it was definitely not the number one topic among the Koreans. It is seen as a much bigger deal to the U.S. South Korea, Mary says, has lived under the threat of being overrun throughout its history. It is a real part of everyday life. Right. She says, the U.S. is now more interested as the new weapons can threaten our West Coast. And Mary, thank you so much for the story and for your thoughts. What do you think, Jennifer?
I actually think this is a really key point, which is we've talked about the fact that having this more liberal leader in South Korea combined with a potentially more hawkish American administration, this might lead to some pretty interesting times in the alliance. But there's a really important sort of development that's beneath this that really needs to come out, which is there's an extremely unwelcome change that we're in the middle of that's leading the U.S. to think about and talk about some really difficult decisions at this point, and that's that North Korea is on the path to having the capability to strike the U.S. with nuclear weapons. So to have this capability, North Korea needs two things. It needs a nuclear capability. It needs a nuclear device that's sophisticated enough, that's small enough, as Chris mentioned, and sophisticated enough to sustain this really long and punishing trip and, you know, re-enter the atmosphere and so on. And it needs a delivery system that can get the device there, so an intercontinental ballistic missile. And North Korea has never successfully tested this, but it's got several programs going on. It's working on this technology, and it's making progress. So I think this is the reason why we've seen so much churn in the U.S. at this time. Partly it's that we have a new administration with the temperament, perhaps, to be more hawkish. And then also it's this underlying, it's really a tectonic change in potentially U.S. policy toward the Korean Peninsula.
Let's take a call. And again, you can join us with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. Chime in by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And John's in Goffstown. Hi, John. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to ask the question. A lot of people talk about Kim Jong-un as a crazy man, and I just wondered what your guests think about whether he's acting as a rational actor in the international scene or if he is really a crazy man.
Well, John, thank you so much. And we kind of touched on this earlier, Chris, but this is the impression that a lot of Americans have. So go ahead.
I really, obviously, trying to figure out what's going on in North Korea is like an economist trying to figure out when the next recession is going to happen. But one thing I would say is that some of the things that we've been able to watch from afar makes him out as what President Trump just said, he's a pretty smart cookie. And I find it interesting that I'm agreeing with President Trump with Korean policy. But I think he is. When he came into power, when his father died, he made sure that his number one opponent, his uncle, was not only arrested on television, but was put to death. He made sure that his stepbrother, who seemed to be had much closer relations with the Chinese, was going to be killed in the Kuala Lumpur airport in Malaysia by VX chemical poisoning. He has had to make sure that he has command and control over his military, which runs North Korea. And frankly, he's got everybody talking about him. So I think at this point, people are seeing him as having, to a certain degree, consolidated his control over North Korea. And the actions he's taking now is the only real ace he has in the hole. His ability to disrupt the entire East Asian peninsula. And as Jennifer was talking about, the potential of attacking the United States. That's why we're talking about him. And now that's, to me, as President Trump would say, that's a pretty smart cookie.
Well, and it's a great question, John. Thank you. And, we've talked about how isolated North Korea is, how it's kind of off on its own or seems to be much of the time. Do you know, Jennifer, if North Korea has so few friends, how have they acquired the information, the knowledge to develop pretty sophisticated weaponry? I mean, we're talking about, hitting the West Coast here.
Well, again, they see this as vital to their existence, to their survival, and so they're devoting quite a lot of resources to it. They have a tiny gross national product, but they devote 25% of that to defense. By contrast, most countries, I think the global average is about 2%. So a full quarter of their economy goes into defense. Now, again, it's a tiny amount in the aggregate because their GDP is so tiny, but they're really trying. They're trying very hard. So that's a really important thing to understand with respect to how much they care about these weapons.
Go ahead, Chris.
And just following up on what Jennifer was saying, that most of these weapons are domestically developed, however, with help from the outside. You would think it was the Soviets or the Chinese.
Well, that's the question, yeah.
But some of that technology, for instance, Yongbyon was set up by the Russians, but not the nuclear technology. Apparently, they got that from the Pakistanis, from A.J. Khan.
Okay. Wow. That opens up a whole another line of questions. We will stop for just a moment and come back after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does
the Electoral College work?
Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, dealing with North Korea. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We'd love your questions, comments, concerns about North Korea's role in its region. President Trump recently said the era of strategic patience with North Korea is over, as the country's regime increasingly threatens the region with both actions and words. And of course, there have been the missile tests that we have heard so much about, some worrying that those could threaten America's West Coast. On top of all this, South Korea had elections last night with its new president saying he supports a sunshine policy with North Korea. We'd love your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. A couple emails here I'd like to share with both of you. Jack asks, would it help ease tensions between the U.S. and North Korea if the U.S. were to move our 28,000 troops and weapons out of South Korea? Jack says, can South Korea deter or defend itself against North Korea on its own? And Jennifer, it's a good question. What do you think?
Well, South Korea is, in terms of the quality of its armed forces, is vastly superior to North Korea's military. North Korea has a lot of people. It has 7 million people in its reserves, 1 million people in its active military. So they have a lot of people, but they are so cut off from the global economy. They've been under sanctions and so forth that their technology is vastly inferior. That's not to say they can't inflict a great deal of pain on South Korea, on Japan, and maybe someday on the continental United States. But yeah, I mean, South Korea, there's no contest here. South Korea could defend itself. It's a rich country. It could spend a lot more on defense than it currently spends. So, but the question is would a withdrawal of U.S. troops be seen as basically a sort of invitation for North Korea to be more violent toward the South?
Interesting. All right. Well, Jack, thank you for the email. And here's another one from Sarah in Concord. She says, not advocating for this in any way, but wondering why, with our advanced technology and espionage capabilities, the U.S. has not done what we've done in many other countries, particularly in South America, of toppling this regime and ending the conflict. And, you know, Chris, Sarah's right. In the 70s and 80s, you know, there are a lot of cases of the U.S. kind of nudging certain regimes over in favor of others. So she asks, why don't we just do this in North Korea?
Well, it's kind of an interesting question because Kim Jong-un has just accused the United States and the South Koreans of trying to assassinate him.
In fact, some of these arrests have been made on charges of, you know, espionage, hostile activities, and so forth.
Which is interesting in itself because the university where these two professors were from is a Christian university. Is the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. And it's but going back to that question, you know, I always remember during the Cold War the exploding cigars with Fidel Castro. We didn't get anywhere with that. But the North Koreans have been extremely good at killing the South Koreans, whether they were in Burma or other places, that the North Koreans have been very adept at doing it. I have no idea what the South Koreans have attempted to do or the Americans. However, you can bet that the number one of our primary groups that we're following throughout the world are the North Koreans, whether they're involved in counterfeiting our money, selling drugs abroad. There's all types of horrendous things that they do, as well as killing other South Korean politicians. So I think there's a degree to which that we're trying to contain this. The degree that we can actually have an impact within North Korea, well, I'm not aware of our capabilities of doing that. No, the Chinese might have that capability, but we don't.
Laura, can I follow
Yeah,
up?
Sure. Go ahead, Jennifer.
I just want to say, again, I have no idea. I'm guessing we've tried. I know that we heard stories of Kim Jong-il would sleep in a different palace every night because, again, he was convinced that the United States was trying to kill him, probably for very good reason, given the long history of covert operations that we've done. But I would just, again, caution, just take a step back and say, okay, so imagine Kim Jong-un dies tomorrow. I think the notion that this would lead to sort of this uprising and the freedom of the North Korean people and the, you know, unification peacefully through, you know, toward a democratic government, that's a long shot. What's far more likely is that there's, again, this guy's really good at staying in power. This family's really good at staying in power, so they've done everything they possibly can to minimize a coup. But that's the most likely route to his death. If there was a coup, then now we've just got a different strong man in power. And so the situation, we've only changed the last name of the guy in power.
Right.
Here's a tweet that came in. This person didn't give a name. He or she says, did I hear the UNH professor say that he teaches where Korea is first? This person says that is troubling that even freshman college students don't know. Thank you for that tweet. Chris, that was you.
I know it was me. Well, it's unfortunate. I think the education here in New England and New Hampshire is very good. Unfortunately, we have de-emphasized Asia. And I think people will know where London is and England is. But it's been one of the issues that UNH has been addressing in the past 20 years, trying to bring the rest of the state up to speed with the rest of the world, recognizing that where the most dynamism has been taking place, whether it's economic dynamism, and of course our wars, has been in Asia. And so that the more that our students understand about this, then the less type of misperception can occur.
Well, and you and I have talked about this before.
Yes.
Most schools, at least at the middle and high school level, don't teach Chinese or Korean or Japanese. It's still, you know, German, Latin.
Teaching of Spanish is extremely important. I'm a major proponent of international education. I just think there needs to be a balance. And for those that have attempted to learn critical languages such as Russian or Chinese or Japanese or Korean, it takes a little bit more time than Spanish or German.
So starting early.
Forget French.
All right. Well, and that's another subject, but I hear
Can I
your
just
point
add
on
also?
That. Yeah, Jennifer, go ahead. This lack of understanding.
Yeah, it really is so apparent in people's history education. There's very much a Eurocentric focus in people's discussion of current events. If you turn on the TV, everything is going to be about the Middle East or Putin. Today it's about Comey.
Right.
But so seriously, there is just not a whole lot about Asia. And it's in Asia that we have this war that we've been talking about that could break out at any time. We have this regime that's causing a lot of trouble for the U.S. And also we have the rise of China, the rise of a great power competitor, which is the most dangerous thing that can happen in international relations. And that, because there's no real breaking news, is essentially just bypassed. Hmm.
Here's an email that just came in from Roger. And Roger, thank you so much. He says the solution is diplomatic. Over time, the goal can be met with skilled diplomatic efforts. The North Korean threat is intensified through poor diplomacy and fear-mongering. Roger says, even if North Korea is capable of reaching the U.S. or its allies with nuclear weapons, what is the scenario that they would foolishly launch one of those weapons, a move that would be met with a fierce and devastating response? Any other solution, he says, military or subversive, will result in incredibly foolish, costly, and deadly outcomes. Roger says, letting Iran out of jail was a move and a model for dealing with North Korea. Support the sunshine policy of the new president in South Korea, he says, and let them work their way toward reunification. Roger, thank you again. And Jennifer, you know, we talked earlier about the sunshine policy, but let's talk about it a little bit more. Just listening to you and Chris, it sounds like this new South Korean president, Mr. Moon, wants to warm up relations with North Korea, maybe putting South Korea on an opposite path from the United States, which has talked about, you know, isolating and sanctions until they give up their nukes. So I just wonder what you think about that.
The importance of diplomacy is really always key to come back to, and I'm glad Roger is bringing us back to that. And particularly for an American administration that we have now that's not really, how shall I put it, filled with experienced diplomats and I'll leave it at that. We should be a little concerned about the kind of day-to-day management and upkeep of our diplomacy with South Korea and also concerned about what sort of messaging we're doing toward North Korea. So diplomacy is really significant. Okay. I guess I would disagree that the Sunshine Policy is an approach that would lead to the goal of denuclearizing North Korea. I think that's clearly not the case. It clearly failed, and it's not going to work. It might, as I mentioned before, it might help build up North Korea to be less of a basket case economically. And if that's your goal, if you're Seoul and that's your goal, then maybe you're just content with that. But if the U.S.'s goal remains to get those nuclear weapons out of North Korean hands, then the Sunshine Policy is just clearly not the policy for you.
Let's take another call. And this is Ray in Keene. Hi, Ray. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome. Oh, Ray, we missed you. Okay. Well, hopefully Ray will call back. We have just a couple minutes left. So, Ray, be good to get your call in. You know, what about the point that Jennifer made, Chris, that the Sunshine Policy, you know, as warm or hot as it may be, isn't going to convince North Korea to say, okay, we will just give up those nuclear weapons. But could it move North Korea to feel less threatened and so maybe it wouldn't use the nuclear weapons?
Right. I like to go back to the mother whose son or daughter came back from Korea, and the concern about what the South Koreans are looking at. And I think, you know, they haven't been focusing on this as much as the Chaebols and the large conglomerates and corruption and so forth. And in the background is this fear. When we're dealing with North Korea, I think our number one ally has to be the South Koreans. And we can't be dictating to them what they want to do. It just so happens that the current leader is at this point says that he wants to reopen the Sunshine Policy, but he hasn't said that he wants to get rid of the THAAD system, of this kinetic energy system, the missiles
system,
and so forth. And I don't think that you're going to find any Korean president that is going to unilaterally disarm. I think, though, that this kind of rebuilding the cooperation that had been occurring with the six-party talks, I think that's something that we need to be looking forward to. Whether or not we can get the South Koreans and the Chinese on board together to see what we can work out with North Korea, because I completely agree with Jennifer that the Sunshine Policy had its problems. But I wouldn't say it's necessarily dead. I'm thinking that we're entering into a new phase.
Let's take another call. Len is in Merrimack. Hi, Len. You're on the air. Thanks for calling the Exchange.
Thank you. This is the one and only area like what Donald Trump is doing, because I'm rather known in some ways. I think diplomacy is very important, but this is the one regime in the world that does not like not behaved diplomatically and never has and has not responded well to previous diplomacy. So I think he's making it simpler. Good cop, bad cop. China, the good cop. But if you don't deal with China, you're going to have to deal with us. You know, it's the mentality of the North Korean regime that I think this is good for. It is a little scary. You know, you've got all these caves filled with rockets probably aimed at Seoul. So the South Koreans are the pawns in this game. But I think it's the one approach to be able to get those nuclear weapons out of there through diplomacy. But it's not going to happen unless Kim Jong-un is very nervous.
Well, so kind of echoing, Len, what our earlier emailer, Matt, said, you know, this is not a, how to put it politely, Jennifer, you know, it's not a, North Korea is not a typical actor where typical diplomatic measures are successful. What do you think, Jennifer?
I really like the way Lynn framed all that. So I would agree that if we're an incoming U.S. administration, so you're President Trump and you're coming in and you're looking at the situation, I agree that he has this sense that there's good reason to step up pressure against North Korea because of this looming change that I mentioned before. Again, before, if there was a conventional war on the peninsula and nuclear weapons were used, before that would be a regional disaster. That would be a disaster for South Korea or for Japan, or, you know, it could be an American base over there also. But with North Korea having the ability to hit the United States, that now becomes an American city that's being destroyed. This is a change. This is very, very consequential. And so I can understand with the Trump administration's thought that, hey, we don't like this policy of strategic patience, that we don't like this policy. What can we do? We got to do something. I get that impetus. The second thing to think, though, is, okay, so what's your policy? Right? You have to ask him, okay, you don't like strategic patience. What does that mean? What are you going to do? And so one thing you could say is we're not tolerating any more missile tests by North Korea. Okay, so what does that mean? So it means stepping up sanctions, which means getting the Chinese on board. So that you just have to follow through with, because the Chinese have not actually been pursuing particularly tight sanctions toward North Korea.
And now it sounds like, and pardon me for interrupting, but now it sounds like South Korea also wants to improve economic and other relations. So they're also changing the equation there.
Right. So it seems as if, again, this election is pretty consequential. If you have a government in South Korea that seems to be taking a more dovish approach toward the North at a time when in the U.S. we have an administration that seems inclined, for the reasons I've mentioned and for reasons of, you know, temperament, to take a more hawkish policy, then this is going to be a very interesting time for the U.S.-South Korea alliance.
Isn't that a Chinese curse?
that we live in an interesting time.
Chris, may you live in interesting times.
Well, and President Bush, President Trump has really given us interesting times, because just as the time the election is coming up, he's saying we need to get rid of the Korean-U.S. Free trade agreement, and that they need to pay for the THAAD system. So this is very interesting times.
All right. Well, both of you, thank you very much for giving us an interesting hour. Jennifer, we really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jennifer Lind, Associate Professor of Government at Dartmouth College, where she focuses on international relations and East Asian security. Chris Reardon, always good to see you. Thank you.
Good to see you too.
Chris Reardon, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH and founder of the East Asian Studies minor there. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. And I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.